This is 69, the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been covering the digital signage industry since the dawn of man, first online and now as a podcast. This podcast gives me the time to really talk to people about technology and issues, get past the PR and jargon, and into what stuff actually means. I try to help listeners understand why they should care. The podcasts are free and I try to get a new one out weekly, but I travel a lot so sometimes I'll miss a week. The 69 podcast has been gratefully sponsored and supported since the start by Jeremy Gavin and the fine folks at ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful looking, totally automated content for signage and digital out-of-home networks. Check them out at screenfeed.com. There have been numerous traditional sign companies that have, through the years, developed a sense of their ground shifting and responded by adding a digital component to their business. A lot of the time it hasn't worked out so hot because it's just too far outside what a company knows and does. But sometimes it works, as is the case with Dimensional Innovations. The Kansas City company nicely straddles physical and digital components to jobs, bolstering the idea that having both skill sets and mindsets under the same roof is going to work better than subcontracting. DI, for short, does projects all over the US in particular, and while it has some especially active vertical markets, its work serves all kinds of different use cases. DI does a lot of pro and college sports venue work, but it also does experiences for museums, hospitals, and retail. I had an interesting chat with Chris Riebschlager, who runs the company's software efforts. Hey, Chris, thanks for joining me. Can you tell me what your company does?
Yeah, absolutely. So Dimensional Innovations started in the late 90s as a signage company, like making just traditional signs.
Okay.
And in the time between the late 90s and now, the company has grown to include custom fabrication of all kinds. And in the last 6 and 7 years, we've added a really big technology practice to that. So in addition to building and fabricating and designing spaces, also activating those spaces with interesting technology that's hopefully beautiful and useful and makes spaces better.
And where's the company based?
The company is based in Kansas City.
But you have all offices elsewhere, right?
Yes. Yeah, we have folks that live and work in LA, Atlanta, Minneapolis, a few in Colorado. So yeah, we got kind of presence all over the United States.
Okay. Are those offices or are those like home offices and the epicenter is Kansas City?
The epicenter is certainly in Kansas City. The other offices are focused a lot on project management and sales for the projects that we are working on and supporting in those locations.
Okay.
But yeah, the heart of it's here in KC.
It's interesting. There's been any number of traditional print companies that have taken a look at the digital signage space and tried to get in it, and for the most part have not been very successful because it's just too different from what they normally do. What's been the difference with you guys?
So I think the way we approach spaces, I think, kind of lends well to activating those spaces with both digital signage and more immersive tech installations. I think when we approach a new project, it's really about getting inside the head of the person that is in that space, why they're there, what they're doing there, what's important to them, what's front of mind when they're in a space like that. So we had been, you know, satisfying those needs with, you know, built environmental stuff. And I think it's a natural pivot to then say, okay, what technology could help this person accomplish what they need to accomplish or make this space better or make a bad experience much, much better.
Right. So you're already fabricating physical materials to make a space interesting, and digital allows you to introduce, you know, a different kind of material and make it active and so on, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of what makes us kind of special is that we're doing it this from both sides, right? Both the fabricated and design side, but also the tech side. So I think if you can have that happening on one team, I think the end product always ends up better, because when I have to sit down at the table with a person who's going to build the thing, they understand what I need it to do. I understand what they needed to do. And I think that that hand-in-hand tight integration just makes for better stuff.
And you run the software team, am I getting that right?
That is correct, yep.
How big is that team?
We have 6 developers right now. We also have a 3D team that kind of branched off from my software dev team. They focus on the 3D modeling and animating and also some of the game engine development stuff that we've been getting into with Unreal.
Oh, cool. And if you had to guess, I realize you're not the COO or anything, but do you have some sense of what the split is of your business between kind of analog stuff and digital stuff? Is it like 60-40 and has it evolved?
I'd probably flip that split. So maybe a 40% and then 60% goes to the physical build out. Mm-hmm. It's the blend there is kind of fuzzy. Usually we're, it's not all one or the other. Usually in a client engagement, there's a big fabricated, big build out that we're injecting technology into so that the borders between those two are pretty fuzzy.
And that's kind of how it should happen, right? Because I, God knows I've been involved in projects or been exposed to projects where it's all about the digital side of it. And, you know, they get fixated on that without thinking about the whole experience and the whole look and feel of an environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ideally, I don't want a person walking into a space that we made and seeing a hard delineation between what is like a physical built out piece and what's a digital add-on to that space. They should all feel very cohesive and family together in a way that, you know, makes sense holistically. And we're not, you know, picking apart into digital activation and physical activation.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's helpful that because your company comes out of the physical background that you're not having to rely on third-party fabrication companies to build that side of it. You can control the whole bill of materials, so to speak.
Absolutely. And that's huge, especially when we're trying to make something that no one's ever seen before. You really need that tight integration between the physical engineering team and the software engineering team, because silly things like mounting a camera, like having access to that camera, knowing where cables need to run, the tighter integration you can get between the person building the thing and the person who knows where those wires need to run, that's only going to end in better projects.
Yeah, I mean, you start embedding display technology into, you know, a physical enclosure. If you have no experience around that, you don't know about things like ventilation.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And then you have big problems.
Yeah. And at this point, we've run into all those things. So, you know, we've had all the problems. So at this point, we've hit our stride, and now we've solved all of those once and can not worry about them in the future.
Yeah, which is very helpful, I'm sure. One of the things that was intriguing to me is with a lot of companies I talk to, kind of sort of have a defined vertical or maybe one or two verticals, and that, you know, they're active in hotels or they're active in retail, whatever it may be. And I look at your kind of portfolio of projects and it's like all over the place. You're doing sports stadiums, you're doing work for college athletic teams, but you're also doing work for children's hospitals and museums.
Yeah. Yeah, we do have some verticals that we do specialize in, stadiums being a big one, college athletics being a big one, children's hospitals and zoos being another. Also, there's corporate environments like corporate headquarters. We do a lot of client experience centers, just big immersive environments that usually are attached to a corporate headquarters where they can tour clients through and show their product offerings in a compelling and interesting way.
We're coming out of... hopefully coming out of a pretty rough year and a half in terms of what's been going on and things like particularly the sports industry kind of being on hold, as well as some college athletics, but workplace has kind of bubbled up. What has business shifted in that time?
I wouldn't say shifted. We've definitely the last year kind of forced us to reevaluate some of the things we were doing and the things we were adding to spaces, and being a little bit more mindful of, as things open back up, how are people going to want to interact with things in a space? Are they going to want to touch things? Are we going to need to figure out ways for people to interact without, physically engaging with this stuff? So I don't think our core business changed at all, but the last year was a really interesting opportunity to kind of reevaluate how these interactions work in these spaces.
Yeah, you have a product or service or something called Dive, which is Dimensional Innovations Virtual Experiences. What is that all about, and how has it resonated with the people you're talking to?
So the genesis of that was early in 2020. We were starting, before COVID hit, we had planned a lot of client experience center work with a few clients where we're going to install a bunch of new spaces that would serve in that client experience center capacity, where we're touring clients through and showing off in an immersive environment type of way product offerings. And since that was now kind of off the table for 2020, we had to pivot into, okay, how do we provide that same experience and have that same like docent or client led multi-person experience, but in a way that isn't going to require someone to fly to a place and go into a building that is going to be closed for an indefinite amount of time. So we started messing around with some video conferencing technology and experimenting with ways to take that same content that we had running in a more theater or large screen experience in the space, and how to use that same content, those same ideas, that same spirit, and put it into an experience where a docent could invite a dozen or more people to a website where we're all seeing each other in video, and they're able to tour people through these immersive environments, show content, throw up polls and questions, and different points of engagement there. So the same things that would be happening in that space, just kind of distributed to everyone's devices wherever they are.
Have you seen much take up on that?
Yeah. I think as people got kind of burned out on Zoom mid 2020, people were looking at, okay, this is fine. This is the utility of it is there. It's great. But there's got to be something more we can do with this technology. Like if we can get everyone live audio and video between a bunch of people, there's got to be more engaging things we can do with that. So I think as people started to push at those edges, that was really appealing to people to be able to have what we had in Dive, which is a way to craft a more immersive environment for those people to be in and have a little bit more interesting points of engagement than just sharing your screen and have everyone looking at a PowerPoint or whatever.
It seems a little bit like the virtual trade shows that, of course, came up like crazy in the past year and a half. How does it differ from that?
I think the main focus of Dive is really just that custom content. So it's really the framework is very Zoom-like, right? We have the video and audio connection. That's kind of the solved problem. The more interesting thing in a new client engagement with that Dive is, what are we going to do now that we have basically the entire web stack and everything you can do on a website, everything you can do with live audio and video? What are we going to do content-wise in a compelling way to show off or to communicate the message that we want to communicate?
And now that we're seeing physical trade shows and people are getting on airplanes and flying to go see clients and go to experience centers and do that sort of thing, does your company see Dive as something that was an interim measure and you'll kind of put it back in the closet, or has it got long-term legs?
I think it has long-term legs. I think there's ways that it could be kind of a supplement to what we're already doing in the built-out space. Ways I've thought of incorporating it are even in a client experience center where we have a bunch of people we've invited into a space, there's still maybe subject matter experts or people that we'd want to bring into this experience that, you know, couldn't fly in, or we want them there every day, we could use the same technology to put that person up on a screen. So we can say, now we're going to talk to Todd about X, Y, and Z. And now Todd's in that space. He's 1,000 miles away, but now he's in this environment with us. So I think there's ways we could, you know, incorporate that same tech to enhance and supplement the stuff that we're doing in the built environment.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. Now, I'm not put off by the fact that you're not listening to this podcast to hear me. Just like audiences to any digital signage, you give your attention to content you find interesting or helpful. That's where my company ScreenFeed comes in. Our sole mission is to make your digital signage network more valuable by making content that is more valuable to your audience. If you'd like to drive more attention to your screens, visit ScreenFeed.com to explore the 75-plus content options we've created to do just that. And then give us a call. Now, back to the podcast.
I obviously follow a lot of what goes on in digital signage and innovations and new ideas and so on. And what I saw in the past year and a half is some great stuff, but also a number of times where it really seemed like companies were just trying to find something that they could get attention for and that they mm-hmm. could sell at a time when their traditional products were not really moving. And I would see efforts to do gesture-based interaction, like touchless displays and QR codes. And I was looking at something on LinkedIn yesterday that was like a live person on a camera with her being replicated as an avatar. And I looked at it and thought, well, why are they doing that? I don't want to see something looks like something out of a Japanese anime cartoon. I just like, if this person looks presentable, but like put her on the screen. So what has worked and like, what do you see as being effective and what is just kind of eye candy that gets a client excited for 10 minutes?
Yeah. So we did early in 2020, we decided to pivot on some of our touch activations. We obviously wanted to find a non-touch way to do those. So we did kind of dive into the whole moving the interface to the user's phone method, like just, you know, hitting a website via QR code on the display. And that, I think, is going to be something that, now that we kind of have that kind of locked and loaded, something that we can add as a value add to existing projects. So in the future, if people are going to be a little bit more cautious about what they touch in public space, that's always going to be an option. I don't think touch is going away. Certainly, I think that's going to be always in the mix. But now that we were kind of forced to solve that problem in the moment, I think that's going to be a really great way to kind of value add the work that we do moving forward.
I'm thinking your creative designers have probably found that there are certain applications and situations where that works well and others where it doesn't. Because I've seen pitches for stuff where you're supposed to snap a QR code and launch the controls on your phone and stand right in front of the display and do all that. And I'm just thinking, just touch the damn display and use hand sanitizer after, and it's going to be a lot easier. So where does it best work?
I think it's really contextual to the project. So with something that's really content heavy, where we need a lot of information from the user to present back to them something that they want. Like, for example, we do a lot of work with athletic departments where they want a way for everyone to see every athlete that had attended that school. And that usually involves some text entry, and text entry is usually best done with a keyboard or on-screen keyboard. And with that level of interaction, I mean, there's, yes, you can offload that to a phone, but there's a point where you get kind of diminished returns with that, right? It's driving, like getting someone to take out their phone, scan a code, and then go to the site. That's asking a lot of a person in a space like that, where they really aren't in that mode of paying that much attention, right? So for that, I think for the foreseeable future, I think we're going to, like I said, keep that moving the UI to the user's device as an option. But I think a lot of that is just going to still happen on screen. But there's a lot of interactions that we do that are a lot lighter touch. So motion-driven interactives where we're using a Kinect or a camera to find human bodies in a space, and the interaction is just driven by their motion. I think for that level of thing, that's largely unchanged.
Mm-hmm. And there's no learning curve. It's just it's triggering something because it's picking up that there's something there moving.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is the learning curve important? Because, you know, I think I've said this a number of times on different podcasts. I call a lot of these gesture-based systems that you see in public spaces and like malls and transit stations and so on. I call them stupid people tricks because you're asking people to do things that are, except for the extroverts, it's kind of embarrassing and it takes a while and may not work. And there's a subset of people who would, mostly kids, who would find that exciting, but most adults would go, well, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah. So like you said, kids get it immediately. There's like no learning curve with kids with these motion driven interactions. They mess around with it until they just kind of get it. And then they're, you know, off to the races. Mm-hmm. I think, so there's well-established UI patterns with everything else that we interact with in a given day, like the phone, the computer, we all get how that stuff works. When we're presenting something entirely new to people, I think to get them over that learning curve and to get them over that curve quickly, I think it's just a matter of making it as simple as possible. So I like with Kinect-based installations, I hate introducing the idea of menus there. Like we're thinking in terms of like a mouse in a cursor. I think we need to, you know, take that off the table when we're talking about gesture. You're not there to point and select things. Let's think about different ways that you can use your body as this user interface that isn't just trying to copy paste a mouse interaction or a keyboard interaction.
Yeah.
So
stop thinking about Minority Report.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Minority Report kind of ruined my life when that came out because that like set the precedent. It's like, that was the expectation. Just make it look like it was in the movie, right?
No, and you don't want that, by the way.
It looks cool, but in practice, it's just leads to tears.
Yeah. You, on the company website, you've got a pretty robust resource section and blog posts and so on, and you've written a couple of pieces around generative art. What does that mean to you, and how is it applied?
So art is something that's really important to me, and it's one of the things that I'm just not very good at. Like, I cannot draw to save my life.
Yeah.
But I can program. I can write really decent software. And I've found a way to create art that's interesting to me by using the tools and the software and the frameworks that people smarter than me have created. So generative art, I think, is a really interesting way to explore ways of art making that are kind of a collaborative practice between you and a computer. It's like, I'm setting up some rules about what I want to happen. I set the computer to go follow those rules and make something interesting and present it back to me. And maybe I like it, maybe I don't, but that back and forth between the computer is just a really interesting art making practice to me.
Mm-hmm. And in the context of installations in corporate buildings, public buildings, airports, and so on, how is it applied and what do you need to think about?
So I think there's a lot of things to consider. In past projects, I think a lot of the creative direction comes from existing artwork in this space. So we did some work with Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, and they had already been working with an artist in the Netherlands, I believe, and his work was just in these primary colors, these blue, yellow, and red colors. So we knew we had a palette to work with. There was a lot of previous work already installed in the space. So what we added to that space was just kind of an interactive version of what was already happening there. So it families, well, what was already existing there. But I think that's the primary consideration. What makes sense in that space? What other artwork does this need to kind of live with? But also, I think an interesting way to approach this is like, what other input do we have available? Like, if it's a lobby, do we have the motion of people? Do we have, you know, traffic data or weather data or any interesting data from the company that we're working with that could be incorporated into this piece that could, you know, present some meaningful message through the work? I think there's so many fun opportunities there to incorporate live data and present that back to people in a beautiful and compelling way.
When I have conversations about data visualizations or generative art, I ask the question, and I'll ask it again, is, does it matter when you talk about data inputs, does it matter that the viewers understand that this is why this is changing, because the weather's changing, the wind's stronger, or whatever it may be? Or is it just needs to be visually pleasing?
It really depends on the client expectation there. I mean, to me, you take work like a Rafik Ananal, right? His work is ostensibly like data driven. If I look at one of those pieces, I have no idea what data is being presented to me and what it actually means. Mm-hmm. It looks amazing, but I have no idea. I mean, he could just tell me it's data driven and I just have to take his word on it.
Yeah, I know the Charlotte Airport, for instance, he uses like baggage handling data and things like that on this giant display. But I think like a fraction of 1% of the people walking by would know that's why it's doing what it's doing.
Exactly. And that could be pre-rendered video and no one would ever know, right? But I think there's ways of incorporating those ideas into meaningful representations of that data. So ways we've done that in the past are, we did a lobby screen in Atlanta that was right next to a traffic stop or a transit stop for a train. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, we have the actual transit information for that stop, like the next train arriving in 5 minutes, on the screen. So that's one layer of this piece. But the bigger portion of the screen is given up to this flock of birds, and they're very calm and very chill when there's not a train arriving. And then as the train is approaching, they get more active. There's more happening on screen. So we have the literal data that you need, and also some supplemental, beautiful, interesting thing to show that is connected to that data. So yeah, to me personally, drawing a clear connection between what's happening on screen and the data we're trying to represent is very important to me.
Yeah, it reminds me of there was an ad on just like a digital poster in a subway platform, I think in Stockholm or something like that. And they did this very clever thing where you would have a model in the poster, and as a subway train approached, her hair started to kind of blow back. And then when the subway was, you know, coming into the station, it was like she was in a wind tunnel, and then it would calm down. And I thought, that's very clever. That's driven by data and triggers and everything else. And it's not quite generative art, but it's same kind of thing, where you're there's a relationship between what's happening and what you see.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So for the company, what are some projects that people who are listening to this would be familiar with?
Oh my gosh. Locally here in Kansas City, we have a project that when people ask me where I work, I always say, well, do you know the big books on the library garage downtown? We made those. So it's a parking structure next to the library downtown in Kansas City that we did. It's basically to make it look like a huge bookshelf. And it's a really cool landmark here in Kansas City.
And that, is that an analog thing, or is there a digital component?
That is just an analog.
Okay. And in terms of digital ones, I think you did something with like a big torch or something in a stadium.
Yes, we did. We just installed what is the largest 3D printed structure in North America, certainly, and I think the world, for the Las Vegas Raiders. So for Allegiant Stadium.
Of course it's Las Vegas.
yeah, of course, Las Vegas, right? So we created the Al Davis Memorial Torch, which they had in Oakland. They had a small, like maybe 15-foot tall torch. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to create just a huge monument in the new stadium to that. So we through our LSAM large-scale additive manufacturing machine, which is essentially just a car wash-size 3D printer, we created a huge torch sculpture. I think it's 90 feet tall and has a illuminated LED structure in the center to represent the flame. And it's just a remarkable, amazing piece that...
And that's, I think it's transparent LED, right? Or LED mesh?
I don't think it's an LED mesh. It's LED in that metal structure that they basically made a flame form that goes in the torch and then illuminated that form from within. Yeah.
Right. And have you done many big sort of corporate lobbies and things like that with giant video walls where you're developing content for them?
Oh, absolutely. A couple that come to mind, we just did one last year for State Farm in their headquarters in Bloomington, Illinois. A whole, I think it's a 3,000 or 4,000 square foot space that is kind of like a monument and a museum to State Farm history, which they have a century long history, a lot of artifacts, a lot of video and audio content. It's really an amazing space. We recreated the office of the original founder and then created an interactive where you can kind of explore around the space and find out, like, this is the pen that was actually used to sign the initial corporate contract or whatever. And as part of that, there's also an immersive theater in the center that lets you play different videos that kind of unpack the history of State Farm.
Yeah, and that's a company kind of like Geico that's trying quite hard with its marketing and everything to not be just a boring insurance company.
Yeah, yeah. Insurance can be a pretty dry topic, but we tried to make it as interesting as possible.
My son's in insurance. you could talk a lot about it. I don't want to get him in trouble, though.
Insurance is very fascinating and very important.
It's an amazing industry. With the company right now, what are some projects that over the next 6 to 12 months we should be looking for?
So we have a lot of, I hope I didn't get into trouble talking about these, but we have a lot of activations going in at the new SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles, which is going to be the new home of the Rams and Chargers.
Yep.
So it's, if you haven't seen images of that stadium, it is absolutely bananas. It's got the what is the biggest Oculus LED screen?
Yeah, the giant Halo
right now. Yeah,
Samsung screen. Yeah,
which is absolutely massive, and it's an amazing space to have the opportunity to install some work in. So we have some work for different brand activations in that space. So, and one of the big ones is the YouTube Theater, which is a performance venue as part of the stadium that we did a large LED wall on the outside of that theater, and also a YouTube icon, a structural YouTube icon in the plaza in front of the theater that we have an LED screen in that is going to function as a magic mirror. It's just a fun, interesting, oh, look at me, I'm up there and look all crazy type of thing, but also show off YouTube content creator stuff and highlighting the content creators.
Well, I'm sure the people in LA are excited about the concept of actually going to a football game that has full capacity and is just like, please God, a lot of this stuff just go away as we all get healthy.
For sure.
Yeah. All right, Chris, thank you so much for taking some time with me today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and you learned a thing or two. If you're new to 16.9, it's a podcast that's been around since 2016. You can click around the site and find scores of conversations with smart industry folks. If you're new to digital signage, you need to be reading 16.9. That's at 16-9.net. You'll find thousands of posts by me and expert guest writers about this industry. I don't run a press release republishing mill. If something makes it on 16.9, that means it matters in some way to the business. Everything about 16.9 is free. Great sponsors make my work possible, and one of those is podcast sponsor ScreenFeed. Check them out at screenfeed.com. 16.9 is a product of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare room in my house, now located outside Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.